large snake, large dogs, men with swords, but then we got close to here. Grover was excited. He ran, then we reached this room, and he fell like this.
Did he say anything? I asked.
He said, "We're close." Then he hit his head on rocks.
I knelt next to him. The only other time I'd seen Grover pass out was in New Mexico, when he'd felt the presence of Pan. I shined my flashlight around the cavern. The rocks glittered. At the far end was the entrance to another cave, flanked by gigantic columns of crystal that looked like diamonds. And beyond that entrance, "Grover," I said, "wake up." Annabeth knelt next to him and splashed icy cold river water in his face. "Splurg!" His eyes fluttered. "Percy? Annabeth? Where?" "It's okay," I said. "You passed out. The presence was too much for you."
I remember Pan."
"Yeah," I said. "Something powerful is just beyond that doorway." I made quick introductions, since Tyson and Grover had never met Rachel. Tyson told Rachel she was pretty, which made Annabeth's nostrils flare like she was going to blow fire. "Anyway," I said, "come on, Grover, lean on me." Annabeth and I helped him up, and together we waded across the underground river. The current was strong. The water came up to our waists. I willed myself to stay dry, which is a handy little ability, but that didn't help the others, and I could still feel the cold like wading through a snowdrift.
"I think we're in Carlsbad Caverns," Annabeth said, her teeth chattering. "Maybe an unexplored section?"
"How do you know?"
"Carlsbad is in New Mexico," she said. "That would explain last winter."
I nodded. Grover's swooning episode had happened when we passed through New Mexico. That's where he'd felt closest to the power of Pan. We got out of the water and kept walking. As the crystal pillars loomed larger, I started to feel the power emanating from the next room. I'd been in the presence of gods before, but this was different. My skin tingled with living energy. My weariness fell away, as if I'd just gotten a good night's sleep. I could feel myself growing stronger, like one of those plants in a time-lapse video. And the scent coming from the cave was nothing like the dank, wet underground. It smelled of trees and flowers and a warm summer day. Grover whimpered with excitement. I was too stunned to talk. Even Nico seemed speechless. We stepped into the cave, and Rachel said, "Oh, wow." The walls glittered with crystals, red, green, and blue. In the strange light, beautiful plants grew, giant orchids, star-shaped flowers, vines bursting with orange and purple berries that crept among the crystals. The cave floor was covered with soft green moss. Overhead, the ceiling was higher than a cathedral, sparkling like a galaxy of stars. In the center of the cave stood a Roman-style bed, gilded wood, shaped like a curly U, with velvet cushions. Animals lounged around it, but they were animals that shouldn't have been alive. There was a dodo bird, something that looked like a cross between a wolf and a tiger, a huge rodent, like the mother of all guinea pigs, and roaming behind the bed, picking berries with its trunk, was a woolly mammoth. On the bed lay an old satyr. He watched us as we approached, his eyes as blue as the sky. His curly hair was white, and so was his pointed beard. Even the goat fur on his legs was frosted with gray. His horns were enormous, glossy brown and curved. There was no way he could have hidden those under a hat the way Grover did. Around his neck hung a set of reed pipes. Grover fell to his knees in front of the bed.
"Lord Pan!"
The god smiled kindly, but there was a sadness in his eyes.
"Grover, my dear, Brave satyr, I have waited a very long time for you.
I got lost,
Grover apologized. Pan laughed. It was a wonderful sound, like the first breeze of springtime, filling the whole cavern with hope. The tiger wolf sighed and rested his head on the god's knee. The dodo bird pecked affectionately at the god's hooves, making a strange sound on the back of its bill. I could swear it was humming, "It's a Small World." Still, Pan looked tired. His whole form shimmered as if he were made of mist. I noticed my other friends were kneeling. They had awed looks on their faces. I got to my knees. "You have a humming dodo bird," I said stupidly. The god's eyes twinkled.
"Yes, that's Dee Dee, my little actress."
Dee Dee the dodo looked offended. She pecked at Pan's knee and hummed something that sounded like a funeral dirge.
"This is the most beautiful place," Annabeth said. "It's better than any building ever designed."
"I'm glad you like it, dear," Pan said. "It is one of the last wild places. My realm above is gone, I'm afraid. Only pockets remain, tiny pieces of life. This one shall stay undisturbed for a little longer."
"My lord," Grover said, "please, you must come back with me. The elders will never believe it. They'll be overjoyed. You can save the wild."
Pan placed his hand on Grover's head and ruffled his curly hair.
"You are so young, Grover, so good and true. I think I chose well."
"Chose?" Grover said. I don't understand."
Pan's image flickered, momentarily turning to smoke. The giant guinea pig scuttled under the bed with a terrified squeal. The woolly mammoth grunted nervously. Dee Dee stuck her head under her wing. Then Pan reformed.
"I have slept many eons,"
the god said forlornly.
"My dreams have been dark. I wake fitfully, and each time my waking is shorter. Now we are near the end."
"What?" Grover cried. "But no, you're right here."
"My dear satyr," Pan said, "I tried to tell the world 2,000 years ago. I announced it to Lysis, a satyr very much like you. He lived in Ephesus, and he tried to spread the word."
Annabeth's eyes widened.
"The old story. A sailor passing by the coast of Ephesus heard a voice crying from the shore. Tell them the great god Pan is dead."
"But that wasn't true," Grover said.
"Your kind never believed it," Pan said. "You sweet, stubborn satyrs refuse to accept my passing, and I love you for that. But you only delayed the inevitable. You only prolonged my long, painful passing, my dark twilight sleep. It must end."
"No,"
Grover's voice trembled.
"Dear Grover," Pan said, "you must accept the truth. Your companion, Nico, he understands."
Nico nodded slowly.
"He's dying. He should have died long ago. This is more like a memory."
"But gods can't die," Grover said.
"They can fade," Pan said, "when everything they stood for is gone, when they cease to have power and their sacred places disappear. The wild, my dear Grover, is so small now, so shattered, that no god can save it. My realm is gone. That is why I need you to carry a message. You must go back to the council. You must tell the satyrs and the dryads and the other spirits of nature that the great god Pan is dead. Tell them of my passing, because they must stop waiting for me to save them. I cannot. The only salvation you must make yourself. Each of you must.
He stopped and frowned at the dodo bird, which started humming again.
Didi, what are you doing?
Pan demanded.
Are you singing Kumbaya again?
Didi looked up innocently and blinked her yellow eyes. Pan sighed.
Everyone's a cynic. But as I was saying, my dear Grover, each of you must take up my calling.
But no!
Grover whimpered.
Be strong,
Pan said.
You have found me, and now you must release me. You must carry on my spirit. It can no longer be carried by a god. It must be taken up by all of you.
Pan looked straight at me with his clear blue eyes, and I realized he wasn't just talking about the satyrs. He meant half-bloods too, and humans, everyone.
Percy Jackson,
the god said,
I know what you have seen today. I know your doubts. But I give you this news. When the time comes, you will not be ruled by fear.
He turned to Annabeth.
Daughter of Athena, your time is coming. You will play a great role, though it may not be the role you imagined.
Then he looked at Tyson.
Master Cyclops, do not despair. Heroes rarely live up to our expectations. But you, Tyson, your name shall live among the Cyclopes for generations. And Miss Rachel Dare.
Rachel flinched when he said her name. She backed up like she was guilty of something, but Pan only smiled. He raised his hand in a blessing.
I know you believe you cannot make amends,
he said.
But you are just as important as your father.
Rachel faltered. A tear traced her cheek.
I know you don't believe this now,
Pan said.
But look for opportunities. They will come.
Finally, he turned back to Grover.
My dear satyr,
Pan said kindly,
will you carry my message?
I can't.
You can,
Pan said.
You are the strongest and bravest. Your heart is true. You have believed in me more than anyone ever has, which is why you must bring the message, and why you must be the first to release me.
I don't want to.
I know,
the god said.
But my name, Pan, originally it meant rustic. Did you know that? But over the years, it has come to mean all. The spirit of the wild must pass to all of you now. You must tell each one you meet. If you would find Pan, take up Pan's spirit. Remake the wild, a little at a time. each in your own corner of the world. You cannot wait for anyone else, even a god, to do that for you."
Grover wiped his eyes. Then slowly he stood.
"I've spent my whole life looking for you. Now, I release you."
Pan smiled.
"Thank you, dear Satyr. My final blessing."
He closed his eyes, and the god dissolved. White mist divided into wisps of energy. But this kind of energy wasn't scary like the blue power I'd seen from Kronos. It filled the room. A curl of smoke went straight into my mouth, and Grover's, and the others. But I think a little more of it went into Grover. The crystals dimmed. The animals gave us a sad look. Dee Dee the Dodo sighed. Then they all turned gray and crumbled to dust. The vines withered, and we were alone in a dark cave with an empty bed. I switched on my flashlight. Grover took a deep breath. Are you okay?" I asked him. He looked older and sadder. He took his cap from Annabeth, brushed off the mud, and stuck it firmly on his curly head.
"We should go now," he said, "and tell them. The great god Pan is dead."
Chapter 18. Grover Causes a Stampede. Distance was shorter in the labyrinth. Still, by the time Rachel got us back to Times Square, I felt like we'd pretty much run all the way from New Mexico. We climbed out of the Marriott basement and stood on the sidewalk in the bright summer daylight, squinting at the traffic and crowds. I couldn't decide which seemed less real, New York or the crystal cave where I'd watched a god die. I led the way into an alley, where I could get a nice echo. Then I whistled as loud as I could, 5 times. A minute later, Rachel gasped,
"They're beautiful!"
A flock of Pegasi descended from the sky, swooping between the skyscrapers. Blackjack was in the lead, followed by 4 of his white friends.
"Yo, boss!" he spoke in my mind. "You lived!"
"Yeah," I told him. "I'm lucky that way. Listen, we need a ride to camp, quick."
"That's my specialty! Oh, man, you got that Cyclops with you? Yo, Guido! How's your back holding up?"
The Pegasus Guido groaned and complained, but eventually he agreed to carry Tyson. Everybody started saddling up, except Rachel.
"Well," she told me, "I guess this is it."
I nodded uncomfortably. We both knew she couldn't go to camp. I glanced at Annabeth, who was pretending to be very busy with her Pegasus.
"Thanks, Rachel," I said. "We couldn't have done it without you." "I wouldn't have missed it. I mean, except for almost dying and Pan."
Her voice faltered. "He said something about your father," I remembered.
"What did he mean?"
Rachel twisted the strap on her backpack.
My dad's job. He's kind of a famous businessman."
"You mean you're rich?"
"Well, yeah."
"So that's how you got the chauffeur to help us? You just said your dad's name and..."
"Yes."
Rachel cut me off.
"Percy, my dad's a land developer. He flies all over the world, looking for tracts of undeveloped land."
She took a shaky breath.
"The wild. He buys it up. I hate it, but he plows it down and builds ugly subdivisions and shopping centers. And now that I've seen Pan's death?
Hey, you can't blame yourself for that."
"You don't know the worst of it. I don't like to talk about my family. I didn't want you to know. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said anything."
"No," I said. "It's cool. Look, Rachel, you did awesome. You led us through the maze. You were so brave. That's the only thing I'm going to judge you on." I don't care what your dad does. Rachel looked at me gratefully.
Well, if you ever feel like hanging out with a mortal again, you could call me or something.
Yeah, sure.
She knit her eyebrows. I guess I sounded unenthusiastic or something, but that's not how I meant it. I just wasn't sure what to say with all my friends standing around, and I guess my feelings had gotten pretty mixed up the last couple days.
I mean, I'd like that, I said.
My number's not in the book, she said.
I've got it.
Still on your hand? No way.
No, I kinda memorized it.
Her smile came back slowly, but a lot happier. See you later, Percy Jackson. Go save the world for me, okay? She walked off down 7th Avenue and disappeared into the crowds. When I got back to the horses, Nico was having trouble. His Pegasus kept shying away from him, reluctant to let him mount.
He smells like dead people,
the Pegasus complained.
Hey now, Blackjack said. Come on, Pork Pie. Lots of demigods smell weird. It ain't their fault. Oh, I didn't mean you, boss.
Go without me, Nico said. I don't want to go back to that camp anyway.
Nico, I said, we need your help.
He folded his arms and scowled. Then Annabeth put her hand on his shoulder.
Nico, she said, please.
Slowly, his expression softened. All right, he said reluctantly. For you, but I'm not staying. I raised an eyebrow at Annabeth, like, how come all of a sudden Nico listens to you? She stuck her tongue out at me. At last, we got everybody on a Pegasus. We shot into the air, and soon we were over the East River with Long Island spread out before us. We landed in the middle of the cabin area and were immediately met by Chiron, the pot-bellied satyr Silenus, and a couple of Apollo cabin archers. Chiron raised an eyebrow when he saw Nico, but if I expected him to be surprised by our latest news about Quintus being Daedalus or Kronos rising, I was mistaken.
I feared as much, Chiron said. We must hurry. Hopefully you have slowed down the Titan Lord, but his vanguard will still be coming through. They will be anxious for blood. Most of our defenders are already in place. Come.
Wait a moment, Silenus demanded. What of the search for Pan? You are almost 3 weeks overdue, Grover Underwood. Your searcher's license is revoked.
Grover took a deep breath. He stood up straight and looked Silenus in the eye.
Searcher's licenses don't matter anymore. The great god Pan is dead. He passed on and left us his spirit.
What?
Silenus's face turned bright red.
Sacrilege and lies, Grover Underwood. I will have you exiled for speaking thus.
It's true, I said. We were there when he died, all of us.
Impossible. You are all liars, nature destroyers.
Chiron studied Grover's face.
We will speak of this later.
We will speak of it now, Silenus said. We must deal with this.
Silenus, Chiron cut in. My camp is under attack. The matter of Pan has waited 2,000 years. I fear it will have to wait a bit longer, assuming we are still here this evening.
And on that happy note, he readied his bow and galloped toward the woods, leaving us to follow as best we could. It was the biggest military operation I'd ever seen at camp. Everyone was at the clearing, dressed in full battle armor, but this time it wasn't for capture the flag. The Hephaestus cabin had set up traps around the entrance to the labyrinth. Razor wire, pits filled with pots of Greek fire, rows of sharpened sticks to deflect the charge. Beckendorf was manning two catapults the size of pickup trucks, already primed and aimed at Zeus's fist.
The Ares cabin was on the front line, drilling in phalanx formation with Clarice calling orders. Apollo's and Hermes' cabin were scattered in the woods with bows ready. Many had taken up positions in the trees. Even the dryads were armed with bows, and the satyrs trotted around with wooden cudgels and shields made of rough tree bark. Annabeth went to join her brethren from the Athena cabin, who had set up a command tent and were directing operations. A gray banner with an owl fluttered outside the tent. Our security chief, Argus, stood guard at the door. Aphrodite's children were running around straightening everybody's armor and offering to comb the tangles out of our horsehair plumes. Even Dionysus's kids had found something to do. The god himself was still nowhere to be seen, but his two blonde twin sons were running around providing all the sweaty warriors with water bottles and juice boxes. It looked like a pretty good setup, but Chiron muttered next to me, "It isn't enough." I thought about what I'd seen in the labyrinth, all the monsters in Antaeus's stadium, and the power of Kronos I'd felt on Mount Tam. My heart sank. Chiron was right, but it was all we could muster. For once, I wished Dionysus was here, but even if he had been, I didn't know if he could do anything. When it came to war, gods were forbidden to interfere directly. Apparently, the Titans didn't believe in restrictions like that. Over at the edge of the clearing, Grover was talking to Juniper. She held his hands while he told her our story. Green tears formed in her eyes as he delivered the news about Pan. Tyson helped the Hephaestus kids prepare the defenses. He picked up boulders and piled them next to the catapults for firing.
"Stay with me, Percy," Chiron said. "When the fighting begins, I want you to wait until we know what we're dealing with. You must go where we most need reinforcements."
"I saw Kronos," I said, still stunned by the fact. I looked straight into his eyes. It was Luke, but it wasn't. Chiron ran his fingers along his bowstring.
"He had golden eyes, I would guess. And in his presence, time seemed to turn to liquid."
I nodded. "How could he take over a mortal body?"
"I do not know, Percy. Gods have assumed the shapes of mortals for ages. But to actually become one, to merge the divine form with the mortal, I don't know how this could be done without Luke's form turning to ashes."
"Kronos said his body had been prepared."
"I shudder to think what that means, but perhaps it will limit Kronos' power. For a time, at least, he is confined to a human form. It binds him together. Hopefully, it also restricts him."
"Chiron, if he leads this attack..."
"I do not think so, my boy. I would sense if he were drawing near. No doubt he planned to, but I believe you inconvenienced him when you pulled down his throne room on top of him."
He looked at me reproachfully.
"You and your friend Nico, son of Hades."
A lump formed in my throat. "I'm sorry, Chiron. I know I should have told you. It's just..." Chiron raised his hand.
"I understand why you did it, Percy. You felt responsible. You sought to protect him. But, my boy, if we are to survive this, we must trust each other. We must..."
His voice wavered. The ground underneath us was trembling. Everyone in the clearing stopped what they were doing. Clarice barked a single order.
"Lock shields!"
Then the Titan Lord's army exploded from the labyrinth. I mean, I'd been in fights before, but this was a full-scale battle. The first thing I saw were a dozen Lystragonian giants erupting from the ground, yelling so loudly my ears felt like bursting. They carried shields made from flattened cars and clubs that were tree trunks with rusty spikes bristling at the end. One of the giants bellowed at the Ares phalanx, smashed it sideways with his club, and the entire cabin was thrown aside, a dozen warriors tossed to the wind like rag dolls.
"Fire!"
Beckendorf yelled. The catapults swung into action. Two boulders hurtled toward the giants. One deflected off a car shield with hardly a dent, but the other caught a Lystragonian in the chest, and the giant went down. A
Apollo's archers fired a volley, dozens of arrows sticking in the thick armor of the giants like porcupine quills. Several found chinks in armor, and some of the giants vaporized at the touch of celestial bronze. But just when it looked like the Lystragonians were about to get overwhelmed, the next wave surged out of the maze. 30, maybe 40 Dracaenae in full battle armor, wielding spears and nets. They dispersed in all directions. Some hit the traps the Hephaestus cabin had laid. One got stuck on the spikes and became an easy target for archers. Another triggered a tripwire, and pots of Greek fire exploded into green flames, engulfing several of the snake women. But many more kept coming. Argus and Athena's warriors rushed forward to meet them. I saw Annabeth draw a sword and engage one of them. Nearby, Tyson was riding a giant. Somehow he'd managed to climb onto the giant's back and was hitting him on the head with a bronze shield. Bong, bong, bong. Chiron calmly aimed arrow after arrow, taking down a monster with every shot. But more enemies just kept climbing out of the maze. Finally, a hellhound, not Mrs. O'Leary, leaped out of the tunnel and barreled straight toward the satyrs.
Go!
Chiron yelled to me. I drew Riptide and charged. As I raced across the battlefield, I saw horrible things. An enemy half-blood was fighting with a son of Dionysus. But it wasn't much of a contest. The enemy stabbed him in the arm, then clubbed him over the head with the butt of his sword, and Dionysus' son went down. Another enemy warrior shot flaming arrows into the trees, sending our archers and dryads into a panic. A dozen Dracaenae suddenly broke away from the main fight and slithered down the path that led toward camp, like they knew where they were going. If they got out, they could burn down the entire place completely unopposed. The only person anywhere near was Nico D'Angelo. He stabbed a Telekine, and his black Stygian blade absorbed the monster's essence, drinking its energy until there was nothing left but dust. Nico! I yelled. He looked where I was pointing, saw the serpent women, and immediately understood. He took a deep breath and held out his black sword. Serve me! He called. The earth trembled. A fissure opened in front of the Dracaenae, and a dozen undead warriors crawled from the earth. Horrible corpses and military uniforms from all different time periods. U.S. revolutionaries, Roman centurions, Napoleonic cavalry on skeletal horses. As one, they drew their swords and engaged the Dracaenae. Nico crumpled to his knees, but I didn't have time to make sure he was okay. I closed on the hellhound, which was now pushing the satyrs back toward the woods. The beast snapped at one satyr, who danced out of its way, but then it pounced on another who was too slow. The satyr's tree bark shield cracked as he fell. Hey! I yelled. The hellhound turned. It snarled at me and leaped. It would have clawed me to pieces, but as I fell backward, my fingers closed around a clay jar, one of Beckendorf's containers of Greek fire. I tossed it into the hellhound's maw, and the creature went up in flames. I scrambled away, breathing heavily. The satyr who'd gotten trampled wasn't moving. I rushed over to check on him, but then I heard Grover's voice. Percy! A forest fire had started. Flames roared within 10 feet of Juniper's tree, and Juniper and Grover were going nuts trying to save it. Grover played a rain song in his pipes. Juniper desperately tried to beat out the flames with her green shawl, but it was only making things worse. I ran toward them, jumping past duels, weaving between the legs of giants. The nearest water was the creek, half a mile away, but I had to do something. I concentrated. There was a pull in my gut, a roar in my ears. Then a wall of water came rushing through the trees. It doused the fire, Juniper, Grover, and pretty much everything else. Grover blew a spout of water. Thanks, Percy. No problem. I ran back toward the fight, and Grover and Juniper followed. Grover had a cudgel in his hand, and Juniper held a stick, like an old-fashioned whipping switch. She looked really angry, like she was going to tan somebody's backside. Just when it seemed like the battle had balanced out again, like we might stand a chance, An unearthly shriek echoed out of the labyrinth, a sound I had heard before. Campe shot into the sky, her bat wings fully extended. She landed on the top of Zeus's fist and surveyed the carnage. Her face was filled with evil glee. The mutant animal heads growled at her waist. Snakes hissed and swirled around her legs. In her right hand, she held a glittering ball of thread, Ariadne's string. But she popped it into a lion's mouth at her waist and drew her curved swords. The blades glowed green with poison. Campe screeched in triumph, and some of the campers screamed. Others tried to run and got trampled by hellhounds or giants.
De Immortalis!
Chiron yelled. He quickly aimed an arrow, but Campe seemed to sense his presence. She took flight with amazing speed, and Chiron's arrow whizzed harmlessly past her head. Tyson untangled himself from the giant whom he'd pummeled into unconsciousness. He ran at our lines, shouting,
"Stand! Do not run from her! Fight!"
But then a hellhound leaped on him, and Tyson and the hound went rolling away. Campe landed on the Athena command tent, smashing it flat. I ran after her and found Annabeth at my side, keeping pace, her sword in her hand.
"This might be it," she said. "Could be. Nice fighting with you, Seaweed Brain. Ditto."
Together, we leaped into the monster's path. Campe hissed and sliced at us. I dodged, trying to distract her, while Annabeth went in for a strike. But the monster seemed able to fight with both hands independently. She blocked Annabeth's sword, and Annabeth had to jump back to avoid the cloud of poison. Just being near the thing was like standing in an acid fog. My eyes burned. My lungs couldn't get enough air. I knew we couldn't stand our ground for more than a few seconds. "Come on!" I shouted. "We need help!" But no help came. Everyone was either down or fighting for their lives, or too scared to move forward. Three of Chiron's arrows sprouted from Campe's chest, but she just roared louder.
"Now!"
Annabeth said. Together we charged, dodging the monster's slashes, got inside her guard, and almost managed to stab Campe in the chest, but a huge bear's head lashed out from the monster's waist, and we had to stumble backward to avoid getting bitten. Slam! My eyesight went black. The next thing I knew, Annabeth and I were on the ground. The monster had its forelegs on our chests, holding us down. Hundreds of snakes slithered right above me, hissing like laughter. Campe raised her green-tinged swords, and I knew Annabeth and I were out of options. Then, behind me, something howled. A wall of darkness slammed into Campe, sending the monster sideways, and Mrs. O'Leary was standing over us, snarling and snapping at Campe.
"Good girl," said a familiar voice.
Daedalus was fighting his way out of the labyrinth, slashing down enemies left and right as he made his way toward us. Next to him was someone else, a familiar giant, much taller than the Lystragonians, with 100 rippling arms, each holding a huge chunk of rock.
"Briaris!"
Tyson cried in wonder.
"Hail, little brother,"
Briaris bellowed.
"Stand firm."
And as Mrs. O'Leary leaped out of the way, the 100-handed one launched a volley of boulders at Campe. The rocks seemed to enlarge as they left Briaris's hands. There were so many, it looked like half the earth had learned to fly.
Boom!
Where Campe had stood a moment before was a mountain of boulders, almost as tall as Zeus's fist. The only sign that the monster had ever existed were two green sword points sticking through the cracks. A cheer went up from the campers, but our enemies weren't done yet. One of the Dracene yelled,
"Slay them! Kill them all, or Kronos will flay you alive!"
Apparently, that threat was more terrifying than we were. The giant surged forward in a last desperate attempt. One surprised Chiron with a glancing blow to the back legs, and he stumbled and fell. Six giants cried in glee and rushed forward.
No!
I screamed, but I was too far away to help. Then it happened. Grover opened his mouth, and the most horrible sound I'd ever heard came out. It was like a brass trumpet magnified 1,000 times, the sound of pure fear. As one, the forces of Kronos dropped their weapons and ran for their lives. The giants trampled the Dracaenae, trying to get into the labyrinth first. Telekines and hellhounds and enemy half-bloods scrambled after them. The tunnel rumbled shut, and the battle was over. The clearing was quiet, except for fires burning in the woods and the cries of the wounded. I helped Annabeth to her feet. We ran to Chiron. "Are you all right?" I asked. He was lying on his side, trying in vain to get up.
"How embarrassing," he muttered. "I think I will be fine. Fortunately, we do not shoot centaurs with broken... ow! Broken legs."
"You need help," Annabeth said. "I'll get a medic from Apollo's cabin."
"No," Chiron insisted. "There are more serious injuries to attend to. Go, I am fine. But, Grover, later we must talk about how you did that."
"That was amazing," I agreed. Grover blushed.
"I don't know where it came from."
Juniper hugged him fiercely.
"I do."
Before she could say more, Tyson called.
"Percy, come quick. It's Nico."
There was smoke curling off his black clothes. His fingers were clenched, and the grass all around his body had turned yellow and died. I rolled him over as gently as I could and put my hand against his chest. His heart was beating faintly.
"Get some nectar," I yelled.
One of the Ares campers hobbled over and handed me a canteen. I trickled some of the magic drink into Nico's mouth. He coughed and spluttered, but his eyelids fluttered open.
"Nico, what happened?" I asked. "Can you talk?"
He nodded weakly.
"Never tried to summon so many before. I'll be fine."
We helped him sit up and gave him some more nectar. He blinked at all of us, like he was trying to remember who we were, and then he focused on someone behind me.
"Daedalus," he croaked.
"Yes, my boy," the inventor said. "I made a very bad mistake. I came to correct it."
Daedalus had a few scratches that were bleeding golden oil, but he looked better than most of us. Apparently, his automaton body healed itself quickly. Mrs. O'Leary loomed behind him, licking the wounds on his master's head, so Daedalus's hair stood up funny. Briarez stood next to him, surrounded by a group of awed campers and satyrs. He looked kind of bashful, but he was signing autographs on armor, shields, and t-shirts.
"I found the 100-handed one as I came through the maze," Daedalus explained. "It seems he had the same idea, to come help, but he was lost, and so we fell in together. We both came to make amends."
"Yay!"
Tyson jumped up and down.
"Briarez, I knew you would come."
"I did not know,"
the 100-handed one said.
"But you reminded me who I am, Cyclops. You are the hero."
Tyson blushed, but I patted him on the back. "I knew that a long time ago," I said. "But Daedalus, the Titan army is still down there. Even without the string, they'll be back. They'll find a way sooner or later with Kronos leading them." Daedalus sheathed his sword.
"You are right. As long as the labyrinth is here, your enemies can use it, which is why the labyrinth cannot continue."
Annabeth stared at him.
"But you said the labyrinth is tied to your life force. As long as you're alive?"
"Yes, my young architect,"
Daedalus agreed.
"When I die, the labyrinth will die as well. And so I have a present for you."
He slung a leather satchel off his back,
unzipped it, and produced a sleek silver laptop computer, one of the ones I'd seen in the workshop. On the lid was the blue symbol Delta.
"My work is here," he said. "It's all I managed to save from the fire. Notes on projects I never started, some of my favorite designs. I couldn't develop these over the last few millennia. I did not dare reveal my work to the mortal world, but perhaps you will find it interesting."
He handed the computer to Annabeth, who stared at it like it was solid gold.
"You're giving me this? But this is priceless. This is worth, I don't even know how much."
"Small compensation for the way I have acted," Daedalus said. "You were right, Annabeth, about children of Athena. We should be wise, and I was not. Some day you will be a greater architect than I ever was. Take my ideas and improve them. It is the least I can do before I pass on."
"Whoa," I said. "Pass on? But you can't just kill yourself. That's wrong." He shook his head.
"Not as wrong as hiding from my crimes for 2,000 years. Genius does not excuse evil, Percy. My time has come. I must face my punishment."
"You won't get a fair trial," Annabeth said. "The spirit of Minos sits in judgment."
"I will take what comes," he said, "and trust in the justice of the underworld, such as it is. That is all we can do, isn't it?"
He looked straight at Nico, and Nico's face darkened.
"Yes," he said.
"Will you take my soul for ransom, then?"
Daedalus asked.
"You could use it to reclaim your sister."
"No," Nico said. "I will help you release your spirit. But Bianca has passed. She must stay where she is."
Daedalus nodded.
"Well done, son of Hades. You are becoming wise."
Then he turned toward me.
"One last favor, Percy Jackson. I cannot leave Mrs. O'Leary alone, and she has no desire to return to the underworld. Will you care for her?"
I looked at the massive black hound, who whimpered pitifully, still licking Daedalus's hair. I was thinking that my mom's apartment wouldn't allow dogs, especially dogs bigger than the apartment, but I said, "Yeah, of course I will."
"Then I am ready to see my son, and Perdix," he said. "I must tell them how sorry I am."
Annabeth had tears in her eyes. Daedalus turned toward Nico, who drew his sword. At first, I was afraid Nico would kill the old inventor, but he simply said,
"Your time has long since come. Be released and rest."
A smile of relief spread across Daedalus's face. He froze like a statue. His skin turned transparent, revealing the bronze gears and machinery whirring inside his body. Then the statue turned to gray ash and disintegrated. Mrs. O'Leary howled. I patted her head, trying to comfort her as best I could. The earth rumbled, an earthquake that could probably be felt in every major city across the country as the ancient labyrinth collapsed. Somewhere, I hoped, the remains of the Titan strike force had been buried. I looked around at the carnage in the clearing and the weary faces of my friends.
"Come on," I told them. "We have work to do."
Chapter 19. The Council Gets Cloven. There were too many goodbyes. That night was the first time I actually saw camp burial shrouds used on bodies, and it was not something I wanted to see again. Among the dead, Lee Fletcher from the Apollo cabin had been downed by a giant's club. He was wrapped in a golden shroud without any decoration. The son of Dionysus, who'd gone down fighting an enemy half-blood, was wrapped in a deep purple shroud embroidered with grapevines. His name was Castor. I was ashamed that I'd seen him around camp for 3 years and never even bothered to learn his name. He'd been 17 years old. His twin brother, Pollux, tried to say a few words, but he choked up and just took the torch. He lit the funeral pyre in the middle of the amphitheater, and within seconds, the row of shrouds was engulfed in fire, sending smoke and sparks up to the stars. We spent the next day treating the wounded, which was almost everybody. The satyrs and dryads worked to repair the damage to the woods. At noon, the Council of Cloven Elders held an emergency meeting in their sacred grove. The three senior satyrs were there, along with Chiron, who was in wheelchair form. His broken horse leg was still mending, so he would be confined to the chair for a few months, until the leg was strong enough to take his weight. The grove was filled with satyrs and dryads and naiads up from the water, hundreds of them, anxious to hear what would happen. Juniper, Annabeth, and I stood by Grover's side. Silenus wanted to exile Grover immediately, but Chiron persuaded him to at least hear evidence first, so we told everyone what had happened in the Crystal Cavern and what Pan had said. Then several eyewitnesses from the battle described the weird sound Grover had made, which drove the Titan's army back underground.
"It was panic," insisted Juniper. "Grover summoned the power of the Wild God."
"Panic?" I asked.
"Percy," Chiron explained. "During the first war of the gods and the Titans, Lord Pan let forth a horrible cry that scared away the enemy armies. It was his greatest power, a massive wave of fear that helped the gods win the day. The word panic is named after Pan, you see, and Grover used that power, calling it forth from within himself."
"Preposterous,"
Silenus bellowed.
"Sacrilege. Perhaps the Wild God favored us with a blessing, or perhaps Grover's music was so awful it scared the enemy away."
"That wasn't it, sir," Grover said. He sounded a lot calmer than I would have if I'd been insulted like that. "He let his spirit pass into all of us. We must act. Each of us must work to renew the wild, to protect what's left of it. We must spread the word. Pan is dead. There is no one but us."
"After 2,000 years of searching, this is what you would have us believe?"
Silenus cried.
"Never. We must continue the search. Exile the traitor."
Some of the older satyrs muttered assent.
"A vote,"
Silenus demanded.
"Who would believe this ridiculous young satyr anyway?"
"I would," said a familiar voice.
Everyone turned. Striding into the grove was Dionysus. He wore a formal black suit, so I almost didn't recognize him, a deep purple tie and violet dress shirt, his curly dark hair carefully combed. His eyes were bloodshot as usual, and his pudgy face was flushed, but he looked like he was suffering from grief more than wine withdrawal. The satyrs all stood respectfully and bowed as he approached. Dionysus waved his hand, and a new chair grew out of the ground next to Silenus's, a throne made of grapevines. Dionysus sat down and crossed his legs. He snapped his fingers, and a satyr hurried forward with a plate of cheese and crackers and a Diet Coke. The god of wine looked around at the assembled crowd.
"Miss me?"
The satyrs fell over themselves, nodding and bowing.
"Oh, yes, very much, sire."
"Well, I did not miss this place,"
Dionysus snapped.
"I bear bad news, my friends. Evil news. The minor gods are changing sides. Morpheus has gone over to the enemy. Hecate, Janus, and Nemesis as well. Zeus knows how many more."
Thunder rumbled in the distance.
"Strike that," Dionysus said. "Even Zeus doesn't know. Now, I want to hear Grover's story, again, from the top."
"But my lord,"
Silenus protested.
It's just nonsense.
Dionysus's eyes flared with purple fire.
I have just learned that my son Castor is dead, Silenus. I am not in a good mood. You would do well to humor me.
Silenus gulped and waved at Grover to start again. When Grover was done, Mr. D nodded.
It sounds like just the sort of thing Pan would do. Grover is right. The search is tiresome. You must start thinking for yourselves.
He turned to a satyr.
Bring me some peeled grapes, right away.
Yes, sire.
The satyr scampered off.
We must exile the traitor,
Silenus insisted.
I say no,
Dionysus countered.
That is my vote.
I vote no as well,
Chiron put in. Silenus set his jaw stubbornly.
All in favor of the exile?
He and two other satyrs raised their hands.
3-2,
Silenus said.
Ah, yes, Dionysus said. But unfortunately for you, a god's vote counts twice, and as I voted against, we are tied.
Silenus stood indignant.
This is an outrage. The council cannot stand at an impasse.
Then let it be dissolved,
Mr. D said.
I don't care.
Silenus bowed stiffly, along with his two friends, and they left the grove. About 20 satyrs went with them. The rest stood around murmuring uncomfortably.
Don't worry, Grover told them. We don't need a council to tell us what to do. We can figure it out ourselves.
He told them again the words of Pan, how they must save the wild a little at a time. He started dividing the satyrs into groups, which ones would go to the national parks, which ones would search out the last wild places, which ones would defend the parks in big cities.
Well,
Annabeth said to me, Grover seems to be growing up. Later that afternoon, I found Tyson at the beach, talking to Briaras. Briaras was building a sandcastle with about 50 of his hands. He wasn't really paying attention to it, but his hands had constructed a 3-story compound with fortified walls, a moat, and a drawbridge. Tyson was drawing a map in the sand.
Go left at the reef,
he told Briaras.
Straight down when you see the sunken ship. Then about 1 mile east, past the mermaid graveyard, you will start to see fires burning.
You're giving him directions to the forges? I asked. Tyson nodded.
Briaras wants to help. He will teach Cyclopes ways we have forgotten. How to make better weapons and armor.
I want to see Cyclopes,
Briaras agreed.
I don't want to be lonely anymore.
I doubt you'll be lonely down there, I said a little wistfully, because I'd never even been in Poseidon's kingdom. They're going to keep you really busy.
Briaras's face morphed to a happy expression.
Busy sounds good. I only wish Tyson could go, too.
Tyson blushed.
I need to stay here with my brother. You will do fine, Briaras. Thank you.
The hundred-handed one shook my hand about 100 times.
We will meet again, Percy. I know it.
Then he gave Tyson a big octopus hug and waded out into the ocean. We watched until his enormous head disappeared under the waves. I clapped Tyson on the back. You helped him a lot.
I only talked to him.
You believed in him. Without Briaras, we never would have taken down Campe. Tyson grinned.
He throws good rocks.
I laughed. Yeah, He throws really good rocks. Come on, big guy. Let's have dinner. It felt good to have a regular dinner at camp,